Welcome to Built to Go, a van life podcast. I'm your host, Jeff Wagg, coming to you from the College of Curiosity. This time it's episode 236, and we're going to talk about 10 Black Friday deals to consider. Yes, I know, everybody's doing these videos this time of year to boost their affiliate links, and oh, I'm trying it too. We're also going to talk about fire logs and why you should never, ever use them for cooking. A tale from the road involving a concentration camp, and I promise it's not what you expect, and a place to visit that involves washing tunnels. Anyway, welcome back. Thank you very much for joining me. A little bit of business to take care of here before we start. First, I want to say thank you to everybody who reached out after last week's episode. As expected, I received comments both positive and negative, and I appreciate that most of the comments were positive. I expect we now have fewer listeners on this podcast, and that is just fine. I want to focus on the folks who were positive, and I really appreciate it. And that positivity bled over into people offering financial support for the podcast. So to those folks, I especially want to thank them specifically, and they are Dave, Michael, Donnie, and Hal. All of you guys, thank you so much. And because of your generosity this week, I'm going to offer something to everybody. Now, this has nothing to do with whether you've donated money to the show or anything like that. If you are a listener to the show and you live in the United States or Canada, and unfortunately because of postage, those are the only two places that I can do, you may receive a Hook Waka Bang sticker or a Hook Waka Bang pin. Now, these are pins like those 80s band pins that everyone used to wear in the 80s. Am I the only one that old that remembers the 80s? These are nickel-sized metal pins that you can wear on anything you'd like, and they are the Hook Waka Bang symbol. Some of them say College of Curiosity on them, some of them do not, and they were all handmade by the inimitable Susie Lee, and they're pretty cool. I like them a lot. I give them to all the people who travel on my trips, and you can have one. All you have to do is send your mailing address to jeff@builttogo.com. That's two T's, not three, not one. I am not collecting your addresses. I am not creating a massive database to spam you or anything like that. I just simply need your address to mail you the pin or the sticker. This is completely free of charge. No obligations. It's just, hey, this symbol, which is a question mark, a greater than symbol, and an exclamation point, seems to resonate with some people. I would like to promote it, and it is what the College of Curiosity is about, and I thought I'd share that with you as a thank you to the support I've received from the community when I sorely needed it. So thank you. Now, I feel terrible about this episode because I hate being like this. I hate producing things just to make money. And I'm actually not doing that, but I kind of am, because what I'm about to present to you is a list of 10 things that you might consider for Black Friday that I found on Amazon that I thought were particularly interesting. Everybody does this time of year because affiliate links make them money. And if you're looking for a way to make yourself some money while you're traveling, this is actually not a bad way to do it. The way it works is, if you promote a link on Amazon and you set up everything with them ahead of time, of course, they will give you a tiny percent of the revenue they receive from people clicking your links, and then they will send that to you in the form of an Amazon gift card. Basically how it works. So if you find something you like, and let's say you have a podcast or a blog or a video, whatever, you can do a review of it or talk about it, just put a link in there, and everybody who clicks on that link and buys something, a little tiny bit of money will go to you, and it doesn't cost them any more. That's the basic premise of affiliate marketing. I've been doing it for years. If you live in the US, you do have to put in an FTC notice saying that some of the links are affiliate links, which I have in all of my show notes. But anyway, that's what I'm doing here today, just this once. I've promised myself I would do this every year. And honestly, I'm much more interested in these weird products than I am about any revenue that they might generate. But I want to be upfront about what happens when people do this. If they're presenting you with the 10 best Black Friday deals, they are probably looking for affiliate dollars. And they're probably doing high price things, but you're going to see here that, well, a lot of these things are actually not high price. Anyway, enough. Let's dive in. Number one. It is the Super One retractable car charger, 4-in-1. This is something that plugs into your cigarette lighter or your cigar lighter in your vehicle, and then this box kind of sticks out, so you have to have space for it. But inside that box, there are three things on one side. That is a 3-amp USB-C charger port. Beneath that, a 2.4-amp USB-A charger port, the common normal one that won't be normal much longer. And below that, a voltage meter that reads out the voltage of the battery, which is a handy thing to have. But wait, there's more. On the left side, there are retractable cables. And in the example they show here, one is a lightning cable for the older Apple devices, and the other is USB-C. The cables are built into this box, so you just pull them out on a reel and charge with them, and when you're done, you just push them back into the box. So you never have to worry about not having cables. I think it's an interesting idea. I think for some people, this is really going to be appealing. For example, if you're doing Uber or something and you need like a charger for your guests, or if you often have passengers and they want to charge their phone, but they didn't bring their own cables, etc. This is kind of a cool thing. Now, it's $20, which is actually a little bit expensive for these chargers these days, but I haven't seen one before that had the cables built in exactly this way. I like that they all go away. So it'd also be a great travel thing. You could just pop it into any vehicle and have all the cables you needed. It does come in colors, but hey, it's $19.87 right now on a Black Friday deal, and I think it's worth it. So you can give that a look if that sounds like something you would like. Number two, I hate the name of this. It is the Hygiene Joy, no rinse bathing wipes. Hygiene Joy? I mean, okay, fine. You got to pick a name. That's what they picked. These, I've talked about before, these are a slightly different brand, but this is a 75-pack of these basically disposable washcloths that have soap already in them, and you don't need any water. And they're typically meant for medical purposes, like you have somebody who's bedridden and you want to help them clean up, that kind of a thing, but they're great for van life. Rather than getting the baby wipes that you have to use 300 of, or having to use water because that's in short supply, these are kind of the ideal non-water way to clean up. Now, I recommended the 75-pack one because at $26, it's only 35 cents a sheet. There is a 25-pack one that you can get that's less money, but of course, it's 40 cents per sheet, so you pay a little bit more. If you just want to try it out, get the cheaper one. But I have used a competing brand of these by Stryker, who is a medical brand, that cost a lot more, and I love these things. They are great. I travel with them everywhere. I mean, no, they're not as good as a shower, but they're much better than baby wipes. You get a bigger washcloth that's thick, it doesn't rip, and you can do a lot more with it. So this is a great thing, and it would be an interesting gift to give people because it's one of those things that people don't think about, and they might be really thrilled to find. So that is the Hygiene Joy No Rinse Bathing Wipe. And of course, I have links to all these in the show notes because that would be the point. Number three, the most expensive thing I have on this list is the Jackery Explorer 1000 V2. Jackery, you know what Jackeries are. We've talked about them a million times. This is the latest version of the 1000 series that has some really nice things, such as a folding handle, which I think they've needed since day one. And it has all the ports you need. It has three AC outlets. It has USB-C. It actually has two USB-Cs, a USB-A. It has a normal 12-volt cigarette lighter plug. And honestly, that's it. It's fairly minimal as far as these power stations go. It does have a light, and it's a nice shape. And because the handle folds now, you could like put it on a shelf more easily. It wouldn't take up as much space. But the reason I'm recommending this isn't because of all that. It's because it's only $399. This is the cheapest I've ever seen. Not only that, there's a $50 coupon built into Amazon right now. So it's $349 for a 1000 series power station. That's 1,500 watts of AC and 100 watts of USB-C. This absolutely will charge your computer and everything else. If you're doing a no build or you're just looking for a backup power station, this is a great choice. And you know, if you have a CPAP, it'll work great for that. This is beefier than any of the 500 series, and honestly, that's how much the 500 series used to cost just a couple years ago. So I've looked at the EcoFlows and the Blue Eddies and the DJIs that are in this category. They are also on sale at a decent price, but the Jackery for $350 seems to be the best price right now for a 1,000 series power station. So if you've been waiting for one, well, you have to jump in at some point. I might be talking about this next year, and it might be only $200. Who knows? But you got to jump in at some point, and heck, this looks like a really good time to jump in. Number four, the Dibbms. Why do they name these things like this? D-I-B-M-S, Dibbms. One-pack camping string light. This is a cool thing you may have seen before. Imagine Christmas lights that went into a hockey puck. That's basically what this is. It is a string of lights that you can pull out of a hockey puck-shaped thing and hang them on your awning or over the top of your rig or inside your rig. And then you can press a button and it will all roll back up into the hockey puck, and that itself can serve as a light. So it's really flexible lighting that you can use in any way that you want. It comes in a colored version. It comes in a white version. You get to pick. And it's rechargeable, of course. You're not going to use up any AA batteries here, and it uses very little power anyway, so a charge is probably going to last a really long time. But the best thing is it's only $13.99. $13.99. This literally would make a great stocking stuffer or gift for somebody in van life or for you, and you could buy more than one, and it could be your primary lighting source. Check out the link. There's video in there. It shows how it works. And they look great, and it even gets good reviews. This thing's got 4.4 stars. That tells me that it's actually not just a piece of junk. It's going to last. Oh, and how long is the string of lights? It's 33 feet. All right, no, it's not. It's 32.8 feet. It's very long. I mean, that's enough that you could probably go down one side of your van and around the back and mostly up the other side, too. So check it out. I'm ordering this for myself because I think it's really cool. Number six, here's something I've had on many rigs, but I haven't seen mentioned in a while, and I still think it's a great idea. It is the auto angle lens. And by auto, it means automotive. It's a piece of plastic about the size of a piece of paper, a bit thicker, and it's see-through, but it's a lens. It's like a big magnifying glass in a way, but you put it on the back window of your van or truck or whatever, and it lets you see like below the door. I mean, it bends light so that you can see things that you couldn't see just looking through the window. And it's really useful for backing up because you could see like if there was a kid behind your van or something like that. Now, the distance that you are from this thing will affect how well you can see out of it, of course, and it's certainly not a replacement for a backup camera. But it's a pretty good thing to have. It lets you look at a glance to see if there's anyone right behind your vehicle. And it also shows a little bit more on the sides. So I am a fan of this thing. I've used it in a few different vehicles, including RVs. And I think, honestly, I almost think that this should be just kind of default in all vehicles because it really helps with your visibility. What I really, really like, though, is it's only $11. I paid a lot more than that for my first one decades ago. So for $11... heck, a nice little safety thing. Great gift for somebody. Number six, car door open warning reflective stickers. These are just what they sound like. These are little reflective stickers, and you put them in the door jamb of your vehicle. Not actually in the jamb, but on the door, so that they are seen when you open your door. And the idea is that at night, if you open your door and there's a car coming, the light will hit this reflector and give them a big bright light so they know you're there. It's just a little bit of a safety thing. It helps with cyclists too, because doors are very dangerous for cyclists, and they're only $5. You get four stickers, one for each door on a four-door vehicle. Obviously, if you have a van, you're going to put one on the driver's side, the passenger side, and the two back doors probably. Just a simple little inexpensive way to make yourself a little bit safer at night and protect not only you, but others who might not realize that your door is open. Number seven, Coughlin's 9961 Multi-Spice Multicolor Paprika Curry Cayenne Garlic Salt Black Pepper and Salt. Basically, this is the one spice shaker to rule them all. It's a single container that has all these different spices in it, not mixed up. There's a different lid for each one. And when you're in a no-build situation or you're in a tight space, you don't have space for a lot of spices, and yet you still want to be able to spice your food a little bit, well, these are the most common spices, and they're all in one container. container. And that means they can't rattle around or anything. You don't have to wonder like, oh, where did the pepper go? I found everything else, but I can't find the pepper. It's all in one thing. And you can refill it. It's a little tricky. There are videos about how to refill it. You basically have to put a screwdriver in and pry the top off. But it's a nice little thing to just throw in a drawer and know that you have all the spices. And it's only $7.79. And if you look at the cost of spices these days, that's not bad. That really isn't. Spices have gone crazy. So I like it. My one complaint about this one, though, is that it doesn't have Italian seasoning, which is something I use a lot. But in reality, I use so much of it that I would want to have a separate one anyway because I wouldn't want to empty this all the time. So $7.79, I think if you with spices with you but don't want to go crazy, this is a great simple solution. Number 8. These are fun. I haven't tried them yet, but I am intrigued. This is a rechargeable window vac with a squeegee. So why would you want to vacuum your window? To get the condensation off. We all fight condensation. We've talked about ventilation many, many, many times. But in the morning, you get up and you just want to drive and you pull down your shade off your front window and it's a sea of condensation. You're like, argh. So you get your rag and you start wiping it off, but you realize you're just moving the water around and you're making this huge mess. And then later on in the day when it all dries, it's like noon and you look out and your window's all foggy because that water left a residue. This is supposed to defeat all that because it's a vacuum with a squeegee on it. So you squeegee the window, just like you were washing it or you're at the gas station doing your window. You squeegee the inside of the window, and all the water from the squeegee goes into a little vacuum container. And then you just have like this cup of water that you can pour out or, you know, use to flush your toilet or whatever you want to do with it. Add it to plants. Doesn't matter. It's relatively clean water. I mean, you could drink it if you had to, except that it probably came out of your lungs, and that's just a little weird. Anyway, I'm intrigued by these things. I think they are probably a good idea. They do take up some space. You know, if you're in a minimal build, this is the kind of luxury item that you may not want to have. And they're a bit expensive. The one that looks the best to me is $45, which seems like a lot. It does come with a telescoping handle so you can get all the windows, but if this is a constant problem in your life and you'd really like it solved once and for all, heck, give it a shot. It's made by Karcher, is a brand I actually know that, so that is the Window Vac Squeegee. Very interesting idea. Number 9. The Luminade Solar Camping Lantern. Remember Lucy Lights? I haven't seen them for a while, but they made a big splash. And these are basically inflatable solar lights. So imagine a cube that's made out of vinyl, and then at the top there's a solar cell, and underneath the solar cell there's a light. The idea is you leave it outside during the day, it gets all the solar charge, and then at night you inflate it, and you have this lovely soft light that will last all night long. That's the basic concept. Well, the problem with Lucy Lights was, in my opinion, is that they were too expensive. That was just an awful lot of money for something like that. And now they're a lot cheaper. So this Luminade lantern is only $23.96. And then there's actually a cheaper one. If you get the one that does colors, it's only $21.21. And this is basically a permanent light that you will always have anytime you need light. As long as it gets a solar charge every day, it's going to work. So that might be something you're interested in. And finally, another thing that I think I'm going to get is the Kitchen Gadget Set 5 Pieces. So I seem to be focusing on minimalist things here today, saving space, but I guess that's what my mindset is. You know, you don't want to bring your whole kitchen with you in your van. I mean, some people do. If cooking's your main thing, that absolutely makes sense. But you start adding these things up, and, you know, you've got the cheese grater you use once a month, you've got the potato peeler, you've got the pizza cutter, the bottle opener, and a grinder. I mean, all these things take up space. Well, this company, whose name isn't really apparent, I guess it's Essie Hoozy, has come up with this basically key ring of tools. It's 5 pieces. These are very small. You know, if you were going to use them all the time, they'd be too small, you'd go crazy. But in a pinch, it has all those things I just mentioned in one key ring of things. And Heck, you just throw it in a drawer next to the spices, and you've got everything you need to do a lot of the basic kitchen functions. And it's only $7.99. So, you save money and space. That certainly sounds like a van life win to me. So it's only $7.99. I'm going to get that one, too. I'm actually buying stuff here, making this podcast for you. That's how it goes. But, no, check that out. I think that's a very cool thing. And that's it. I'm done selling you stuff. Those are my 10 things for this year. I will probably continue to do this every year. It just makes sense, and I think it's fun for some people. I also feel a little cheesy doing it, so I apologize for that. But we're going to move on now to the regular content. Van Life News. So Al sent me an email a while ago and said, check this story out. And, I did, and this is a scary story. We've talked about toll roads a lot. And I've just recently mentioned that toll roads now are starting to charge not only by axle, which they've done for years, but also by height. So if you have a two-axle Sprinter van, you can actually pay twice as much toll as if you have a low-roof Sprinter van. That's scary. And the scariest part is, you don't know how much it costs. You just get on the road, and you're driving along, and then weeks later, you get this bill in the mail. Well, this happened to a guy in an RV. He was driving along and took a toll road. He knew he took a toll road. He wasn't too worried about it, but, you know, whatever. I'm going to save time. I'm going to take the toll road. And he saved about 20 minutes by this route, and then he got the bill in the mail. How much do you think the bill was? If you guessed $100, you are incorrect. If you guessed $400, you were incorrect. It was $569 to drive on this road. And the problem is he got all these things added up. He got the toll for riding on the road. He got the toll for the axles. He got toll for the height. And he got the toll for time of day. They were doing like surge pricing. So, yeah. And this happened in Virginia, by the way. This wasn't in some weird place. This was just on the road in Virginia. I'm not a fan of this. I really feel like we need something that tells you how much tolls cost or gives you some kind of a warning or whatever. Back in the day, if you rode on a turnpike, which is what a lot of the interstates were called, you'd go to a toll booth and you were handed a ticket, and it would tell you the price at every single exit. If you're getting on at exit 10 and you're going to exit 20, it's going to cost $2. I feel like we need something like that again, and I don't know how we're going to get it because the pricing is so dynamic. Different vehicles are paying drastically different amounts. If you're in state, out of state, if you have an easy pass, if you're tall, low, high, I mean, it's crazy. And I have reasons to drive to New England now. My son Fisher started a new band. I'd love to go see them, but when I look at how much it costs to drive, it's not the gas or diesel that's bothering me now. It's the tolls. So I'm actually looking at ways to go without tolls, which take longer and cause more driver fatigue. I'm actually might go through Canada. Believe it or not, from Chicago to Burlington, Vermont, it's shorter to go through Canada. I might start looking into that. But then I have the problem of taking the ambulance across the border, and there may be an eyebrow raised or two at that, and I'm a little concerned. But anyway, yikes. In more yikes news that actually isn't yikes news, California is banning diesel RVs starting next year. Sounds scary, right? That diesel Sprinter you have, that's a camper van, they're going to ban. No, it's not quite that bad. So California has very strict automotive regulations. We've known this for a long time, and that's a result of the terrible smog they had in the 70s. If you hadn't seen L.A. in, say, 1972, you really have no appreciation for how bad the smog was. It was bad. The sky was permanently orange, you couldn't see anything, and breathing was unpleasant. So California and the United States government created the Environmental Protection Agency, and California created their own, and hey, the air's clear now. I mean, if you go to LA now, the air looks perfectly fine, and it is. It's much, much better. So it worked. However, one of the ways they did that was to impose strict regulations on car emissions. And they're continuing in that pattern. They're pushing EVs, but basically what they're doing is they're telling every automotive and truck manufacturer, you have to have so many vehicles that do this and so many vehicles to do that. It's a very complicated formula, but that formula boils down to the fact that large RVs made by, say, Freightliner won't be allowed to be sold in California because the company, Freightliner, doesn't meet these requirements. And that's because they're a big truck company. They don't sell electric trucks. They don't have any zero emission vehicles at all. Companies like Ford and Chevy can get around it because they have some electric vehicles, etc. So if you are looking for a big diesel pusher in California, you're going to have to buy it out of state. That's basically all this means. If you are a normal van life person in a quote-unquote normal van, whether it's diesel or gas, this doesn't really matter much because anything under 7 tons is exempt. Most of us are going to be just fine. And if you don't live in California, this has no bearing on you whatsoever. So you'll see a lot of hype about this and people will go, ah, but it's really not that big of a deal. And, well, it's up to you to decide how much air quality is worth. I think the people in LA are pretty fond of breathing. So maybe they've gone too far, maybe they haven't. I will leave that up to you. Autoblog recently came out with a list of the best roads in the U.S. And by the best roads, I don't mean the best roads to drive on for, you know, the experience, which I did a podcast about a while ago now. No, I mean, the roads that won't drive your fillings out of your mouth because they're in such bad shape. And the results are interesting here. Let's go over them. Now, having driven around the country quite a bit lately, I have my opinions of which states have better and worse roads. But let me give you their list here. And again, this is from autoblog.com. Links in the show notes, of course. Number one state in the United States with the worst roads is Hawaii. Yeah, Hawaii's got terrible, terrible roads. Now, there's not much van life in Hawaii for a lot of reasons. But know that if you go there and rent a car, you might encounter some really bad roads. And heck, volcanoes might have something to do with that. Number two, Rhode Island. Little tiny Rhode Island. But little tiny Rhode Island has a lot of roads, and apparently they're not doing so well in keeping up with them. Number three, New Mexico. New Mexico's got the opposite problem. They're a very large state with very few people and huge long stretches of roads. And yeah, they've got a lot of bad roads in New Mexico, apparently. I think you're going to be fine on the interstates, but once you get off the interstates, it's going to be a little bit rough. And number four, and those of you living in this state were kind of laughing about Rhode Island, is Connecticut. Connecticut has the fourth worst roads in the country, and people who live there know this. In fact, they're one of the loudest. I've heard that from a lot of people, that Connecticut has terrible roads. And being one of, if not the wealthiest state in the country, there's really no excuse. Number five, Mississippi. But you know, if you're going to take a trip to Mississippi, do you want good roads? I mean, if you're looking for the Mississippi experience, to me, it's kind of going down these old roads in the bayous and in the backcountry and seeing all the Spanish moss and everything. And I don't know, seeing a bright, fancy new road there would kind of take away from it. But anyway, that's number five, is Mississippi. Now, to be fair, we should talk about the best states for roads. And believe it or not, the state in the United States that has the best roads, according to Autoblog, is Alabama, which, as you may recall, is right next to Mississippi. In fact, they're kind of mirror images of each other. Alabama has the best roads in the country. And number two, Indiana. And you know what? I will back this up. I recently drove from, where was I? I think I was in Atlanta. From Atlanta up through Indiana, and I was amazed at how much better the roads were once I got to Indiana. Not all of them. I ran into some really bad roads in Indiana, but by and large, it was some very comfortable driving there. Number three is Wyoming, which is interesting because if you look at New Mexico and Wyoming, they have a similar problem. Wyoming has even fewer people, yet somehow their roads are better. And I think maybe all these other states need to go visit Wyoming and figure out exactly how they're doing that. Number four is Kansas. I rank Kansas as an underrated driving state, and they're in very good shape. So Kansas gets a win, and I agree. And number five, Idaho. Idaho, that funny, skinny, weird-shaped state, has really good roads. So that's the news for this time. And thank you for those who sent me news articles. Feel free to send me a news article that you think I should mention. Again, Jeff at built2go.com. Two T's, not three, not one. You've heard that before. Tech Talk. I watched a video of a gentleman living in a van in Massachusetts, and he was, you know, doing the van life thing. He had some interesting ideas, and one of the things he did was he would stop at parks and cook up a whole bunch of food on the grills that were at the parks, which I thought, oh, that's an interesting idea. And then he would like make bags and freeze them, and he basically do all his cooking at once and then live off that for the whole week. And I was like, okay, interesting idea. Now, he went to get charcoal and he couldn't find any, so he bought a fire log instead. And what a fire log, I mean, is those paper-wrapped kind of fake logs that you might use in a condo where you didn't want to have any real wood because you didn't have a place to put it, that kind of a thing. He was cooking on that, and it seemed to work as far as, it heated up his pans and stuff. He had terrible soot on everything. And as it happened in the video, the cops came and shut him down because there was a fire ban and there were no signs. And anyway, and I'm not mentioning this guy specifically for two reasons. One is, I'm a little embarrassed for him, and the other is, I don't remember. I don't remember where he went. I apologize for that. But let's cut to the chase here. Do not cook on fire logs. They are not safe for cooking. They aren't. Fire logs are made out of sawdust and paraffin wax, and then all kinds of stuff added to make them have colors and scents. I mean, there's even Kentucky Fried Chicken scented fire logs. I don't know what that's about. But they're not safe for cooking, and if you read the wrapper, it actually says, do not use for cooking. The smoke from these things will contaminate your food. It'll make it taste bad. It may have weird heavy metals in it, because that's where the colors come from. So don't cook with fire logs. I understand it's convenient, and they're not terribly expensive, and they last a long time. No, there's much, much better ways. Get some charcoal, or get some raw coal, or fat wood, or anything else. Go find some sticks. Don't cook with fire logs. And this guy seemed to know that. He mentioned it in the video, and then he did it anyway. And I was like, ah. So, not only that, I could see in the video his pans were getting wrecked. They were getting covered with this sticky soot. And then, what are you going to do with those pans? You don't really have a great industrial cleaning center in your van, probably. You've got to bring these dirty, filthy things in there. Anyway, bottom line, do not cook with fire logs. If you want to get one for a late night campfire just for fun, that is fine. Tales from the road. Okay, this is a weird one. On my Danube cruise, I had the opportunity to go to a concentration camp. Now, that concentration camp is called Terezin. It is in the Czech Republic, which wasn't the Czech Republic then. And it's got a very long history. It was a fort built to keep the Prussians out in the 18th century. And the fort itself is very impressive. They let us go into the tunnels a bit, and there's like 20 kilometers of tunnels underneath the fort. It's a shame that this became a concentration camp. You could say that about any place. But in particular, this place, because it would have been a very cool place to visit without this dark history put on it. Now, I have never been to a concentration camp. I have been to a Holocaust museum. I know how that affected me. And I expected to go to the concentration camp and just be, you know, kind of devastated for the day. And, you know, of course it was devastating. But it also wasn't quite what I expected. In fact, I don't know if I'm wrong about my perceptions or what, but the tour seemed to have the same tone and tenor as a ghost tour. And I'm bothered by that, but I can't exactly figure it out. So you tell me if I'm just being crazy or if that's what was going on. First off, we have to recognize that these folks do not speak English as a first language, and I do not speak Czech as any number of languages. So they were native Czech speakers giving a tour in English, and while their words were right and I understood them, intonations, inflections, areas of focus, all this stuff, I can't really put a lot of stock in because I don't know how much of it was trying to translate versus how much was what they were intending. But I'm going to tell you what I experienced. So we got on the bus to head there, and the very first thing tour guide number one, there were two, tour guide number one says is, unfortunately, we're going to Terezin today. And I thought, well, that's an unusual way to start a tour. I mean, okay, we're on vacation, we're here to have fun, and today we're going to go to one of the most depressing places on the planet. I understand the sentiment, but was that the right word, unfortunately? I mean, I don't know. It set a strange tone right away, like, oh, I'm sorry we have to go to this place. There's so many better things to do. It's like, but okay, whatever. I'm going to chalk that up to differences in language, etc. Not a big deal. So we drive out there, and we get to the concentration camp, and there's a bit of a walk. You get into the parking lot, and then you have a bit of a walk before you get to the actual buildings. And what you walk through is a massive cemetery. It's a very large cemetery, and they have erected a massive Star of David on one side and a massive cross on the other. And that's how you start. And there wasn't any tour guiding at this point. Our first guide was just leading us to the entrance gate, basically. And we hadn't even met the second guide yet. So there was a lot to see in this section. You know, there were stones placed on some of the graves, which is a Jewish tradition. And there were flowers placed on other graves. And then some graves had no names. Clearly, we were entering a place that had a history. And I expected to feel bad. I expected to just be sad and without any hope for humanity at all by the time we got through this trip. The first thing, when we get through the gate, there was a gift shop. Exit through the gift shop, even at the concentration camp. I get it. They have to make money. That's how it is. And the gift shop wasn't selling, like, greetings from the concentration camp or anything like that. It was mostly books and things that mattered. But still, I was like, that's interesting. And then there were vending machines. They had some fancy coffee vending machines. And I just took note of that. And then we met the second guide. And now this second guide works at the concentration camp. That's the only thing he does. And, you know, he wasn't with our group. The first guide was like, had been with our group for a couple days. He's like, welcome to Terezin. And he explains the history of the concentration camp, which is a bit more complicated than you might think. And I can't get into it in this story too much, but suffice it to say that this camp was formerly a fortress. It had then been turned into a prison for political dissidents. And then finally in World War II, it wasn't so much a concentration camp like Auschwitz or Dachau. It was a place where people were sent to gather them to transport them to places like Auschwitz and Dachau. This wasn't an extermination camp. There were showers there, but they weren't those showers. Not that that matters. Terezin was a horrible place, and large numbers of people died, often simply because of the circumstances of their birth. There's nothing good to say about that. It was also a camp that was a little bit of a Potemkin village. You see, during World War II, the Red Cross would come and visit camps, and the Nazi government set up this camp and said, hey, come visit, we'll show you that the Jews are being well taken care of, and they made these propaganda videos that showed all the happy Jews in the concentration camp. And they actually built buildings to support this myth. For example, we saw a wash house that had a big row of sinks and hot water and mirrors and showers. I mean, it didn't look great, but it certainly didn't look like anything we associate with a concentration camp. And come to find out in the tour that it was all fake. I mean, the people in the camp never ever saw that room, and the Red Cross never saw the rooms that they were actually in, stacked by the hundreds in rooms the size of a garage. If you're a tour guide talking about this incredible, devastating human suffering, I would expect a somber tone and very matter-of-fact statements. But instead, what I experienced was the same demeanor and stories that one would find on a ghost tour. We were told about the conditions and the torture, but the way it came across to me, and this might be unfair, I fully admit that, was that he was trying to play up the horror element, much like I've seen in ghost tours. For example, rather than saying people were tortured mercilessly in this place, he would tell us a long story about unusual forms of torture, one involving starving people and them feeding them really salty food and then not giving them water. And in more detail than was necessary. And I just thought, that's just a little odd. And again, is this a cultural difference? Is it a language difference? I don't know. And then we went through and saw room after room, and we were told about how there was one bathroom for 600 people, and it was never cleaned, and people just stopped using it, and it was terrible. All true. Please don't let me give the impression that there was any lying going on here. But I'm like, okay, it's a concentration camp. Then we went to the solitary confinement cells, which I'll put the picture up on the show notes that I took this week. Really frightening place. There was actually one of the cells was populated by the guy who started World War I and then therefore started World War II. That was interesting, although there wasn't all that much conversation about that. Finally, we go outside, and we come to this place where there are two crosses in the ground, and they're sandboxes. So imagine a hollow concrete cross in the ground filled with sand, and there's two of them, and there was a shed roof over them. That wasn't mentioned. I had to ask what that was, and it turned out that those were firing positions for Germans taking target practice. And as you might have guessed, the target practice was on live targets, which was people from the camp. In fact, just before the end of the camp, he talked a lot about how they rounded up 52 Jews and shot them just because they were about to be rescued. That appeared to be the only reason. And then this is what tipped me over the edge as to this way of thinking, like, what's going on here? Why are they treating this like a ghost tour? There was a gallows set up, a place where you hang people, right near this shooting range. And now, I know this gallows wasn't 75 years old. Unless they had been constantly repairing this, and I really don't think they had been. They had built this more recently, in my opinion. But it was a full-size gallows, just like you'd seen in a Western movie. You walk up on the platform, and then, you step on the thing and all that. And they explained that only one person had ever been hanged on that platform. And it was an escapee that they caught, and they did it as, a lesson to everybody else. Somehow the shooting people wasn't enough of a lesson. But then he told a story about how the Nazis thought the gallows was haunted. And they had a legend that if you touched the gallows, 1 year later, you will die. Straight out of a ghost story tour. Exactly what you would hear if you take a ghost tour someplace. And I was like, come on. With all the suffering and stuff that went on here, all the devastation, everything we saw here that is absolutely real and impossible to comprehend, we're hearing a ghost story about a gallows? It just didn't make any sense. And at that point, I was actually angry. So I immediately left the group and walked right over the gallows and put my hand on it and leaned against it. Take that. So, hey, if I die a year from, let's see, what date was it? November 20th? If November 20th, 2025, I'm dead, well, then the curse was true. I'm not terribly worried about it. And I actually saw some people taking my picture while I did that, which is a little weird. But anyway, what a weird experience. I did not expect to go to the concentration camp and come away feeling like I had just been on a ghost tour. And that disturbs me because it should be a completely different feeling. I feel like I should have been moved, and then I was. After we left the camp, we went to a museum that used to be a school. And it was a school where they had sent all the Jewish kids, and it was a normal school. They had classes and everything. And then one day they gathered up all the kids and sent them off to Auschwitz, and that was it for the kids. And what the exhibit in the museum focuses on mainly is all the artwork the kids made while they were in school. And it's the same type of drawings you could see at any school in the United States. And they showed them, and you could just look at these and see, this is the drawing an 8-year-old would make with crayons. And knowing that that 8-year-old never saw 9. That was moving, and that did not involve a tour guide. So I'm just stuck with this weird place trying to think about this thing. I feel like I have not actually seen a concentration camp yet. And if I ever have the chance to see Auschwitz or Dachau or any of the others, I'm definitely going to take it because I feel like that's an obligation I have as somebody who was born in the 20th century to learn about this stuff so that it never happens again. But boy, there are times when I think that that lesson is impossible to learn. A place to visit. Boy, I should have saved that for the end. That's hard to follow up on. At any rate, we did a lot of driving in Austria as we were touring about, and Austria has beautiful, beautiful highways. No, seriously. They call them the Autobahn, not to be confused with the Autobahn in Germany. It's just the German word for highway. Their Autobahns, which do have a speed limit, unlike in Germany, it's like 87 miles an hour or something like that, 130 kilometers an hour. Beautiful. And it's not because they're new, it's because the Austrians care about their roads. They're immaculate, and everything is perfect, and they have nice rest areas, and the lines are all in good shape, and the signs are all perfect, and there's lots of tunnels, because Austria has a lot of mountains, and they, instead of going up and down the mountain, they just went through the mountains. And the tunnels are well lit and attractive. There are no billboards, and they even wash the tunnels. They have trucks that go in and wash the tunnels with regularity. Now, I grew up in Boston, or I grew up in Salem, but near enough to Boston. Boston has a lot of tunnels, and I swear you could send archaeologists into those tunnels to dig through the layers of grime and learn what life was like in the 1930s. I don't think they've ever been washed, and that's probably unfair because they probably have been, but wow. Beautiful, beautiful roads. And folks, if you're in Europe and you are in a camper van and you have not driven Austrian highways, take a look. Just go and it's like driving in a video game. Everything is so clean and beautiful. And of course, Austria is beautiful. You have all this beautiful stuff around you anyway. But to see a public work that the local populace cares about so much that they invest money and time and effort into keeping pristine was just a really nice thing. Especially coming from the States, where we have such infrastructure problems and bridges collapsing, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So, yeah, this week my place to visit is basically the highways of Austria, the Autobahns of Austria. Now, note, that kind of ties in this whole episode here, the tolls are dynamic and tricky, and you have to have a little device in your car that talks to the toll transponders and all this. So do your research before you do this, but do it if you can. The roads are absolutely beautiful. Resource recommendation. So, Hiker, who is in my Discord channel, actually both of them, my travel group and my van life group, and is very active, recommended this particular Discord channel to me. And honestly, I think, from what I've seen, this is the premier van life Discord server. And it's called simply #vanlifecommunity. It is a very well-run server. People are asked questions before they can join. There's a very active and effective bot. Moderation looks like it's good. The content is good. If you're a Discord person, or maybe you're not, and you'd like to just have a community that you could talk to while you're on the road. See, this is the nice thing about this. For van life people, you can be anywhere in the world and still be connected to your community with Discord. You can talk to them either via voice or typing. Most of it's by typing. You can share pictures and everything. And they're all your folks. You're not out there in the wild world of X or Blue Sky or anything like that. It's a nice little closed community. And this one seems to be just about the best. So I'll have a link to this in the show notes, and the links are crazy with Discord, so you have to go to the show notes. Or search for #VanLifeCommunity Discord server. I just joined. It looks great. You'll find Hiker and me both there trying to engage. And heck, you're welcome too. So please, come on in. Well, folks, thank you for listening to this rather long episode. I'm very appreciative that you're still here, and we're going to have a lot more content coming soon. Music, as always, is by Simon Wagg. And until next time, remember the words of Paul Thoreau, who said, "Tourists don't know where they've been. Travelers don't know where they're going."